It's a one-time-in-a-lifetime experience, you know? I don't think it'll ever be this good again. It's sort of a shame to peek.
I know, right? It's like my life story. I'm Carrie Thompson, and you're listening to Playback, the podcast that brings you once-in-a-lifetime experiences every month. We have got a really festive holiday sampler for you from December 86, including a chat with film director Oliver Stone talking about making the movie Platoon.
I enjoyed working with the whole new generation of 20-year-old actors who were kids when the war was going on.
And Robert Krowich will describe the unsettling experience of a trip to the ground zero of Toy Store's F.A.O. Schwartz.
There is, among other things, a 12 to 15 foot tall giraffe whose mouth is moving, a train that is rotating around and around whose mouth, this is a train with a mouth, is moving, and it's all happening at once.
Also, some serious sensory overload, courtesy of the Beastie Boys.
We're the kids, and if the kids are united,
they will never
be divided.
Beautiful.
And don't let anybody tell you to do.
People do wackadoo, wackadoo.
So, we ask you, is it possible to have too much of a good thing when it comes to the holidays? Filmmaker John Waters has an answer.
Being a traditionalist, I'm a rabid sucker for Christmas. In July, I'm already worried that there are only 146 shopping days left. As each month follows, I grow more and more obsessed. November 1st kicks off the jubilee of consumerism. By December, I'm deep in eczema psychosis, and only then do I allow myself the luxury of daydreaming my favorite childhood memory, dashing through the snow, laughing all the way, ha-ha, to Grandma's house, to find that the fully decorated tree has fallen over and pinned her underneath. Deeply in debt over Christmas shopping. Always spend an exact correlation as to how much you like the recipient. Aunt Mary, I love about $6.50 worth. Uncle Jim, well, at least he got his teeth fixed, $8. If your Christmas comes and goes without declaring bankruptcy, I feel sorry for you. You are a person with not enough love inside. You can never buy too many presents. If you said excuse me to me on a transit bus, you're on my list. I wrap gifts for non-existent people in case somebody I barely know hands me a present and I'm unprepared to return this gesture. Even though I'm the type who infuriates others by saying, oh, I finished my shopping months ago, as they frantically try to make last-minute decisions, I like to go to the stores at the height of Christmas mania. Everyone is in a horrid mood, and you can see the overburdened, underpaid, temporary help having nervous breakdowns. I always write down their badge numbers and report them for being grumpy. Frosty the Snowman by the Ronettes is my favorite Christmas carol. But I also like the Chipmunks' Christmas album, the Barking Dogs' Jingle Bells, and Santa Claus is a Black Man. If you're so filled with holiday cheer you can't stand it, try calling your friends and going caroling yourself, especially if you're old, a drug addict, an alcoholic, or obviously homosexual and have a lot of effeminate friends. Go in packs. If you are black, go to a prissy white neighborhood. Ring doorbells, and when the father knows best type family answers, start screeching hostily your favorite carol. Watch their faces. There's nothing they can do. It's not illegal. Maybe they'll even give you a present. Christmas Day is like an orgasm that never stops. Happiness and good cheer should be throbbing in your veins. Swilling eggnog, scarfing turkey, and wildly ripping open presents with your family, one must pause to savor the feeling of inner peace. Once it's over, you can fall apart. All sorts of neuroses are permitted. Depression and feeling that it somehow wasn't good enough should be expected. There's nothing to do. There is only one escape from post-Christmas depression, the thought that in 4 short weeks, it's time to start all over again. What are you going to get me?
Now for our next story, which was actually news in 1986, when it was determined that inhaling secondhand smoke was bad for you. Here's a report.
Non-smokers who inhale the smoke from other people's cigarettes run a higher risk of contracting lung cancer and other diseases than non-smokers who are not exposed to cigarette smoke. That's the conclusion of a new report from the Surgeon General. Michael Richards has the story.
The Surgeon General's 17 previous annual reports on smoking and health concentrated on health risks for cigarette smokers. But today's report is the second major document this fall to link secondhand tobacco smoke with potential health hazards for non-smokers. Surgeon General C. Everett Koop said 11 of 13 major studies conducted in the U.S. and abroad indicate increased health risks.
We have biochemical markers which prove non-smokers absorb tobacco smoke. And now a substantial epidemiologic database exists which documents an increased lung cancer risk among non-smokers exposed to tobacco smoke.
Among the conclusions in the report, the finding that many toxic substances, including those linked to cancer, are more highly concentrated in the smoke that goes into the air than they are in the smoke inhaled by cigarette users.
Now let's consider that rare individual who worries about not getting enough secondhand smoke. Author Joe Carson.
This is disgusting to me, and it is going to be even more disgusting to somebody who never smoked. But I haven't had a cigarette for a week and a half, and all I can think about is smoke. It's not nicotine anymore, it is smoke. I can tell you that fresh air is not the same as smoke in your lungs. Coffee isn't coffee without smoke to go with it. Food may taste better, but meals do not come to resolutions without smoke. And what is a kiss if it doesn't taste like a four-alarm fire? Oh, sweet smoke. I sit in the smoking section of restaurants not because I get a cigarette, but because I want to smell the smoke. I hunt for smoke-filled bars because if there's enough smoke, I can drink a beer with a friend without going crazy for a cigarette. One afternoon last week, I stopped and talked with a neighbor, a man I hardly know. He was burning a pile of leaves at the end of his driveway, and I wanted to inhale smoke. I tried to ask a question that might initiate some conversation, but no. We stood with the silence usually maintained by distance squeezed between us, me breathing smoke. "You like the smell of leaves burning?" he finally asked, "or do you just like the smoke?" The smoke. A week ago, I broke down. I bought a pack of Honey Rose herbal cigarettes for the smoker who does not want tobacco, it says on the package. I have it. I carry it. And if I am such a weak-willed, still-smoking ninny that I cannot go for another 10 minutes without smoke, then by golly, I get one. A Honey Rose straight. I quiver a lot, and 3 are missing from the pack, smoked by me, they tell me.
We love to smoke till our lungs turn gray. We love to smoke 17 packs a day. We love to smoke like a chimney, although we'll croak before 2003.
And now, here's John Hockenberry with an interview he probably still regrets doing.
Right, the first thing I want to know is just what were you guys doing back in second grade, huh?
I picked my nose a lot. I'd take the girl in front of me, her pigtails, tip them
Actually, me and Peter Parnell and Louis Castro used to beat up a girl named Lee Wywy every day.
Me and David Miller used to build with blocks and then kick them over when the teachers weren't looking and plug wires into the circuit breaker and try and blow out all the lights, usually successfully.
One of the early discoveries of growing up is that elementary school pranks become felonies when committed by teenagers. Unless you were the Beastie Boys. Michael Diamond, Adam Yauch, and Adam Horvitz have managed to make their mischief a paying proposition, to say the least. The Beastie Boys have the hottest-selling debut album Columbia Records has ever put out. It's called Licensed to Ill, and it has sold 700,000 copies in 5 weeks.
Girls are the kinds I like. I'll steal your honey like I stole your bike.
My father, he's jealous because I'm making that green. What? Gotta hunt the girlies number from the places I've been.
The Beastie Boys are the first white rap band to hit the charts. This is significant because while black rap artists are very popular in terms of record sales, rap has a problem in the record industry known as no crossover. Except for one or two acts, rap has failed to attract a mass white audience. Why a white rap band?
Why not?
We like the music. Why we just not? Have a good time playing it.
We grew up in Manhattan. I mean, when we were going but to high school, we were listening to rap music. Eventually, we started to do it ourselves. We happen to be white. Yes, this is true.
Why did the Rolling Stones play the blues? I figure they just liked the music.
You guys have been opening for black acts, right? For
yeah.
Run DMC.
We spent the whole summer doing the Raising Hell tour with Run DMC.
What was that like? Isn't there a moment of skepticism at the beginning when you're out there in a completely black audience?
No, because they usually know our music already from black radio, and they know our music and they like it.
I mean, ironically, it was like over the summer we were getting really frustrated because it looked like we were just only going to be accepted by black radio and by the black audience, and that was going to be it forever.
What turned the tide, though? What changed that?
What changed it? Putting out Fly Records.
If you hang on the streets of New York, you know that Fly Records are hit records.
City to city, I'm running my ride. On location, touring around the nation. Beastie Boys, always on vacation. Beastie Boys, stable turntable. I do what I do best because I'm really not able.
The Beastie Boys are produced by the most important rap record label, Def Jam, which also produces Run DMC, the black rap act, which has successfully made it onto MTV and white radio. Like Run DMC, the Beasties mix their rap with heavy metal guitar. The people at Def Jam Records want the Beastie Boys to make rap acceptable to white radio.
We're white, and if it takes us being white to break it that much into the radio, then that's great. And the next black group that comes along that plays this kind of music, it'll be that much more open for them to be played on the radio because we're able to break ground that they can't.
John, we're looking out for the kids. You know what I'm saying?
A lot of times our music
Talk about looking out for the kids. I mean, Run DMC talks about cleanliness and being like off drugs and get away from gangs and all that sort of thing. And you guys would seem to have a slightly different message.
Well, John, we do have the occasional glass of wine with dinner.
Drink by smoking, here's how you feel.
You put your left leg
down.
Your right leg
up.
Tilt your head back. Let's finish the cut.
With the bottle.
John, I wouldn't say we're alcoholics, but we do enjoy our beer and wine. Perhaps the occasional marijuana cigarette.
It seems like you guys are really embracing something that most rock musicians and performers are on television telling kids to stay away from.
Well, they're all liars. See, we don't actually do drugs, so we think it's funny and we don't give a damn about it. Some musicians have been actually known to speak badly of it and do it. I don't think I have to say anything more there, John. We're not trying to destroy the world, we're just trying to have a good time, man. We're just, you know, trying to party.
Show the kids there's an alternative.
And that's partying.
Does that constitute a message? Do you guys want to say something to America?
Hey, yes. We're the kids. And if the kids are united,
they will never
be divided.
Beautiful.
And don't let anybody tell you what to do.
And kids, give your mom hell.
That's right.
Wackadoo, Bob McAllister.
People too. Wackadoo, wackadoo.
Kids are people too.
Yes.
Do we really need that message?
No. Yes.
No.
Yes.
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 I'll kick you out of my home if you don't cut that hair.
You know, I kind of get the feeling throughout this whole thing that you really don't want to be my friend. Is that right?
John, babe.
John, we want to work.
We like you for the person who you are. We don't know you, dude.
I've got an actual.
Tell us how you feel about, like, you know, your most innermost thoughts, and we'll decide if we like you.
This is your big test here, John.
Well, if I had a sandbox, would you come over and play in it?
You lost.
No.
You lost.
We don't like you.
You lost in a big way there, John. You're doing good up until
If you would have said something like, yo, let's tilt back a couple of brewers, I think
John,
you would have had
John,
us.
I think John lost it when he
As a measure of their artistic integrity and their gratitude over speaking with us, the Beastie Boys kicked around some garbage and tore down Christmas decorations in our New York studios. They appear live tonight as part of the New Year's Eve celebration on the MTV Music Television Network.
It's also time to hear from filmmaker Oliver Stone and that now famous actor Charlie Sheen in a scene from the movie Platoon.
Somebody once wrote, "Hell is the impossibility of reason." That's what this place feels like, hell. I hate it already, and it's only been a week. The hardest thing I think I've ever done is go on point 3 times this week. I don't even know what I'm doing. A gook could be standing 3 feet in front of me, and I wouldn't know it. I'm so tired.
There is a new movie about Vietnam that is receiving excellent reviews. The film is called Platoon. It is a straightforward combat story and a highly complex political story. It comes from Oliver Stone. He wrote the screenplay 10 years ago. It was based on his time in Vietnam, his platoon on patrol. Stone dropped out of college and volunteered. He served 15 months and was wounded twice. He was 20 years old when he arrived in the country. And that's where his film starts, at the airfield. Some older-looking, worn-out soldiers are leaving, along with some body bags, and some very young men arriving.
They were 19, 20, 21. Some of them were 20, a little older. In that particular scene, I used as young as I could get, and then I contrasted them with the older, the same age, but we made them up, the makeup, to look older.
When you watch Charlie Sheen, who plays you at that age on the screen, you've compared him to a young Montgomery Clift. You're also seeing yourself. Is it a difficult thing for you to watch, Charlie Sheen?
No, I kind of like it. It brings me back in time. I enjoyed working with the whole new generation of 20-year-old actors, you know, who were kids when the war was going on. And to them, I'm a bit like a history figure. I personally enjoyed working with them. They had no hang-ups. There was no pretensions.
I want to ask you about Tom Berenger, and I have to tell you this very short story. I saw the film. I watched Sergeant Barnes, who is a terrifying and very large physical presence on the screen, the actor Tom Berenger. And then I was reminded by reading something that this was this very charming person with a mustache who was in The Big Chill, who played the television actor who had that sort of, who had a series. I cannot believe it's the same person.
Yeah. No, he played the Big Chill character was rather slick. He was the one who betrayed the woman, Mary Beth Williams. Yeah, Tom won against type deliberately. He was looking for something meaty to do. By putting him in that role, I think we avoid the cliche of, you know, of dealing. You might think that if the sergeant were too ugly in the beginning, that it you would know the ending. You would know the ending. So we wanted to keep it unpredictable.
And you, of course, knew a Sergeant Barnes or this person when you were there.
Tom is based on a character. I can't tell you the name, but it's he was a sergeant. He was shot several times, I think 6 times. The 7th time, I think he was shot right above the eye. And the bullet lodged in there. He spent a year in Japan, and he came back to the field of his own volition. And I got to be in his platoon.
Was the scar really that terrible?
It was almost exactly what Tom had in the movie.
It begins in his forehead and comes all the way down.
Yes, it was
below
a
his mouth.
Large sickle-shaped thing.
You've written something about when you first went to Vietnam, that you got off the plane and you had fantasies of Lord Jim and Julie Christie. what does that mean?
Well, I was an impressionable young man. I had a rather romantic background and training. And I was in love with the Far East, with the concept of the Far East as I'd read it in the Conrad books. And sort of a lover, fan of Julie Christie and films like Zhivago and Darlene. You know, I wanted to meet her and marry her. Those are the type of fantasies I had then. You know, when we got there, the war destroyed all those romances and illusions that we might have had. I mean, the first week I got the picture. I think I show that in the film.
What do you feel that you have gotten right in the movie that is based on your experience? In other words, what would somebody have gotten wrong had they not been there?
The language. I think the language is one of the harder things to get back in time because we used a very primitive adolescent language. Oh, wow, man, groovy, bummer. A lot of the kids from the 80s had a hard time using that kind of language. Certainly military details are tough to do. Firefights are tough to do. You can't always get all the effects that we had in Vietnam because special effects can't provide some of the things we did. The difficulty was there, but I think the feeling, overall feeling, is pretty authentic.
Mm-hmm. And it's out and it's getting fine reviews, and you feel pretty good about it, I guess.
Top of the world. Never felt better. This is it's a rare thing when you get uniformly good reviews. It's a one-time-in-a-lifetime experience, you know? I don't think it'll ever be this good again. It's sort of a shame to peak.
That's director Oliver Stone talking to Noah Adams.
I'm on top of the world looking down on creation, and the only explanation I can find is the love that I've found ever since you've been around.
And now for a trip through Toyland with Robert Krowich and Scott Simon.
Let's talk about some of the wonder and the magic and the joy of toys and take a brief excursion with Robert Krowich, who's economics correspondent for the CBS Morning News, a regular here on Weekend Edition, and the father of a 1 and 1/2-year-old boy named Jesse. Robert's up in our studios in New York. Robert, I understand you recently took Jesse, your son, for his first trip to what's been described as the ultimate fantasy plush playland for adults and children, too, I must say.
I think it actually may be. And as a native New Yorker, I have gone to FAO Schwartz, the department store, all my life. But what they have done this year, well, not only did it boggle my mind, but we walk into the store and there is before anything else happens, there is a gigantic 2-story-high clock, a tower in the right as you walk in, where there is a song. Which goes, in the clock, tick-tock, where the children play, where the fun and laughter chase the tears away. It's a time. Well, I'm like, blah, 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 blah. Thy son has just walks in the door and stops cold. And he, and this is a boy who's always in motion. He hardly moved for the next 10 minutes. Because in front of him, there is, among other things, a 12 to 15-foot tall giraffe whose mouth is moving, a train that is rotating around and around whose mouth, this is a train with a mouth, is moving, a clock with a tongue going in and out and the mouth is moving, a mouse coming up and down about to grab some cheese whose mouth is moving, cheese moving too, and ballerinas moving, and what's most interesting is their lips are moving in sync to the stupid lyric of this song. And it's all happening at once. And his face first went blank, then went different colors, and every so often he would try to raise his hand slightly to point to something, and then something else would come up. So, for a father, I thought this is the kind of thing a parent dreams of, because you think, I'm going to show you a good time, boy, and then to have a good time register so loudly all over his body. So finally, I picked him up. He was like a chunk of ice, frozen, right? And I moved him around the statue and said, like, the words, because he's learning words. I said, train, Jesse, train! And he goes, in the clock, tick-tock, goes the finish. So his face finally went so blank, I decided I would take him upstairs. We go up the escalator, past the trains, and I could tell you tales of these trains. There's so many trains. But what this FAO Schwartz has done is they've hired actors who are in abundance here in New York. And the actors sit around and demonstrate toys to adults. And, of course, it's useful to them to have a child to work off of. So I had the only child. So he's surrounded by, animated gorillas, puppeteers, going, oh, little boy, come on, yelling, Legoland, come into Legoland, you'll be amazed.
And I was, because what the store has done is they've taken these little tiny Lego parts and they have built something Steven Spielberg would take 2 years to concoct. So yeah. I say to Jesse, actually, this thing you see around you here is made of these tiny little... He is now past it, totally. Yeah. He's like frozen, like his face is completely blank and his tongue is hanging out. So I took him up, he's like a piece of ice, and we walked out into the stormy night. And I all I heard in the back of my ear was, in the clock, tick-tock, we're the children. But he had a wonderful time. We bought, by the way, not a thing.
You heartless father. I think all America needs to know your reasoning on this.
Well, I just, it was so much to look at that maybe with a 1.5-year-old, the subject of having any of it never came up, which actually raises a business question in the back of my mind. Uh-huh. Is this the first store which is so spectacular to look at that you, and they let you play with everything, that you don't really even think of buying it?
Toyland, Toyland. Little girl and
boy. So maybe that's what happened to our next commentator, Catherine Tucker Windham. It seems that Santa forgot to buy her what she asked for one Christmas.
When I was about 5 years old, the only thing I wanted for Christmas was a scooter. But I didn't tell anybody about that, because I believed firmly that Santa Claus knew what you wanted. There was no need to share your secrets with anybody else. Well, Christmas morning early, I waked up and I got out of bed and sat there on the rug exploring the treasures that Santa Claus had brought in the stocking. But I could hardly bear to sit there looking at those things when I knew that out in the living room, under the Christmas tree, was my new scooter. Well, finally, Daddy said, well, the fire's built up in the living room, and I think it's warm enough. Let's go see what Santa Claus brought. And I went running in, and there was a new doll, and a doll bed, and a little blue dressing table for the doll, and a stack of books, but there was not a scooter. And I couldn't believe it. And before I knew what I was saying, I said, but he didn't bring my scooter. Well, I saw Mother and Daddy exchange glances, and I tried to be happy with the toys he had brought, and I looked at the books he had brought, and ate the candy and the fruit. And I heard Daddy say to Mother later in the day, well, I've asked all over town and there's not one here. And then I heard him go into the dining room where we had a telephone up on the wall. And I heard him ask the operator for long distance. And I heard him say Selma and something that I couldn't quite make out. And then later I heard him say, well, Henry, of course I know it's Christmas. That's why I'm calling. And my mother hurried me out of the room. Late that afternoon at dusk, time for the southbound train to run, my daddy said to me, put on your coat, your hat, let's walk down and meet the train. Well, we often did that. Daddy said to me, when it gets real dark, we'll shoot the Roman candles and the skyrockets. And I tried to be happy about that, but all I could think about was that scooter. And the train came in, and the baggage car opened, and there in the light stood the baggage man, and he was holding a bright red scooter. And he leaned out, and he said to me, is your name Catherine? And I said, yes, sir. And he said, well, then this scooter is for you. Santa Claus made a mistake, and he left it at a house way up the railroad, and he meant to bring it to your house here in Thomasville, and he called and asked me to bring it for him. And it was the most beautiful red scooter I ever saw.
Geez, that is just the kind of heartwarming ending I look forward to at this time of year. And here's another ending, or should I say a beginning. Our hardworking intern, Claire DeMura, is heading back to Seattle. And believe it or not, I think she actually liked her gig here at Playback, rooting around in the archives and learning about all things 1980, including Iran-Contra, really.
Now, are you glad you learned so much about Iran-Contra?
Oh, yeah. I feel maybe a little superior to the other interns because I feel like I could actually understand it now, whereas it's just normally one of those things that happened a long time ago and was complicated, and we pass it off as, oh, you know, that 80s thing.
So let me ask you, have you enjoyed your several months as your research intern for Playback?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I get to listen to NPR and get paid for it. That's positive. I pretty much, I don't know, get to do things that I would otherwise enjoy doing as part of a job, and that's not something everyone gets to do. Don't get me wrong, some of them are really boring.
Like what?
There's some really terrible, boring stories.
Did we air them?
No. Well, we aired them a long time ago.
And do you know, can you tell me offhand what year we're moving into in terms of our 25-year plowing through the archives expedition? We're going into what?
1987.
Yeah. Do you know anything about that year?
Not a whole lot yet.
Do you think you'll find something out?
Yeah, well, so far, in just looking at January, it's kind of looking like a lot of Iran-Contra.
Make it sound more interesting.
So far, I don't really know what. There's no big breaking news.
There's pieces about smoking.
There is smoking.
Iran-Contra, and that's coming up next month. And we'll be missing Claire here in Washington, D.C., and wishing her well. Thank you, Claire.
Well, thank you.
Happy New Year, everybody. Here's looking forward to 1987 and 2012, of course. I'm Carrie Thompson, and you're listening to Playback.